Rach sometimes stared at himself in the mirror and wondered how it could be. He was not tall, only 163 centimeters in height, distinctly shorter than either parent. He was rather stocky but muscular, and not fat, with black hair and the distinctive Dalite mustache that he kept as dark and as thick as possible. In the mirror he could still see the street urchin he had once been before the chanciest of great chances had dictated his meeting with Harry indoors. Selden had been much younger then, and his appearance now made it plain that Rach himself was almost as old now as Selden had been when they met. Amazingly, Doris had hardly changed at all. She was as sleek and fit as the day Rach had first showed Harry indoors the way to Mother Rita's in Billybutton. And he, Rach, born to poverty and misery, was now a member of the civil service, a small cog in the Ministry of Population. Selden said, "How are things going at the ministry, Rach? Any progress?" "Some, Dad. The laws are passed, the court decisions are made, speeches are pronounced. Still, it's difficult to move people. You can preach brotherhood all you want, but no one feels like a brother. What gets me is that the Dalites are as bad as any of the others. They want to be treated as equals, they say, and so they do. But given a chance, they have no desire to treat others as equals." Doris said, "It's all but impossible to change people's minds and hearts, Rach. It's enough to try, and perhaps eliminate the worst of the injustices." "The trouble is," said Selden, "that through most of history no one's been working on this problem. Human beings have been allowed to fester in the delightful game of I'm better than you, and cleaning up that mess isn't easy. If we allow things to follow their own bent and grow worse for 1,000 years, we can't complain if it takes, say, 100 years to work an improvement." "Sometimes, Dad," said Rach, "I think you gave me this job to punish me." Selden's eyebrows raised. "What motivation could I have had to punish you?" "For feeling attracted to Joranum's program of sector equality, and for greater popular representation in government." "I don't blame you for that. These are attractive suggestions. But you know that Joranum and his gang were using it only as a device to gain power. Afterward..." "But you had me entrap him, despite my attraction to his views." Selden said, "It wasn't easy for me to ask you to do that." "And now you keep me working at the implementation of Joranum's program just to show me how hard the task is in reality." Selden said to Doris, "How do you like that, Doris? The boy attributes to me a kind of sneaky underhandedness that simply isn't part of my character." "Surely," said Doris, with the ghost of a smile playing at her lips, "you are attributing no such thing to your father?" "Not really. In the ordinary course of life, there's no one straighter than you, Dad. But if you have to, you know you can stack the cards. Isn't that what you hope to do with psychohistory?" Selden said sadly, "So far, I've done very little with psychohistory." "Too bad. I keep thinking that there is some sort of psychohistorical solution to the problem of human bigotry." "Maybe there is, but if so, I haven't found it." When dinner was over, Selden said, "You and I, Rach, are going to have a little talk now." "Indeed," said Doris. "I take it I'm not invited."
"Ministerial business, Doris."
"Ministerial nonsense, Harry. You're going to ask the poor boy to do something I wouldn't want him to do."
Selden said firmly, "I'm certainly not going to ask him to do anything he doesn't want to do."
Rach said, "It's all right, Mom.
Let Dad and me have our talk. I promise I'll tell you all about it afterward.
Dora's eyes rolled upward.
You two will plead state secrets. I know it.
As a matter of fact, said Selden firmly, that's exactly what I must discuss, and of the first magnitude. I'm serious, Dors.
Dors rose, her lips tightening. She left the room with one final injunction.
Don't throw the boy to the wolves, Harry.
And after she was gone, Selden said quietly, I'm afraid that throwing you to the wolves is exactly what I'll have to do, Rach.
Chapter 8. They faced each other in Selden's private office, his thinking place, as he called it. There he had spent uncounted hours trying to think his way past and through the complexities of imperial and Trantorian government. He said, Have you read much about the recent breakdowns we've been having in planetary services, Rach?
Yes, said Rach.
But you know, Dad, we've got an old planet here. What we gotta do is get everyone off it, dig the whole thing up, replace everything, add the latest computerizations, and then bring everyone back. Or at least half of everyone. Trantor would be much better off with only 20 billion people.
Which 20 billion? Asked Selden, smiling.
I wish I knew, said Rach darkly. The trouble is, we can't redo the planet, so we just gotta keep patching.
I'm afraid so, Rach. But there are some peculiar things about it. Now, I want you to check me out. I have some thoughts about this.
He brought a small sphere out of his pocket.
What's that? Asked Rach.
It's a map of Trantor, carefully programmed. Do me a favor, Rach, and clear off this tabletop.
Selden placed the sphere more or less in the middle of the table and placed his hand on a keypad in the arm of his desk chair. He used his thumb to close a contact, and the light in the room went out while the tabletop glowed with a soft ivory light that seemed about a centimeter deep. The sphere had flattened and expanded to the edges of the table. The light slowly darkened in spots and took on a pattern. After some 30 seconds, Rach said in surprise, It is a map of Trantor.
Of course, I told you it was.
You can't buy anything like this at a sector mall, though. This is one of those gadgets the armed forces play with. It could present Trantor as a sphere, but a planar projection would more clearly show what I want to show.
And what is it you want to show, Dad?
Well, in the last year or two, there have been breakdowns. As you say, it's an old planet, and we've got to expect breakdowns. But they've been coming more frequently, and they would seem almost uniformly to be the result of human error.
Isn't that reasonable?
Yes, of course, within limits. This is true even where earthquakes are involved.
Earthquakes on Trantor?
I admit, Trantor is a fairly non-seismic planet, and a good thing, too, because enclosing a world in a dome when the world is going to shake itself badly several times a year and smash a section of that dome would be highly impractical. Your mother says that one of the reasons Trantor, rather than some other world, became the imperial capital is that it was geologically moribund. That's her unflattering expression. Still, it might be moribund, but it's not dead. There are occasional minor earthquakes, 3 of them in the last 2 years.
I wasn't aware of that, Dad.
Hardly anyone is. The dome isn't a single object. It exists in hundreds of sections, each one of which can be lifted and set ajar to relieve tensions and compressions in case of an earthquake. Since an earthquake, when one does occur, lasts for only 10 seconds to a minute, the opening endures only briefly. It comes and goes so rapidly that the Trantorians beneath are not even aware of it. They are much more aware of a mild tremor and a faint rattling of crockery than of the opening and closing of the dome overhead and the slight intrusion of the outside weather, whatever it is.
That's good, isn't it?
It should be. It's computerized, of course. The onset of an earthquake anywhere sets off the key controls for the opening and closing of that section of the dome, so that it opens just before the vibration becomes strong enough to do damage.
Still good.
But in the case of the 3 minor earthquakes over the last 2 years, the dome controls failed in each case. The dome never opened, and in each case, repairs were required. It took some time, it took some money, and the weather controls were less than optimum for a considerable period of time. Now, what, Rach, are the chances that the equipment would have failed in all 3 cases?
Not high?
Not high at all. Less than 1 in 100. One can suppose that someone had gimmicked the controls in advance of an earthquake. Now, about once a century, we have a magma leak, which is far more difficult to control, and I'd hate to think of the results if it went unnoticed until it was too late. Fortunately, that hasn't happened, and isn't likely to. But consider. Here on this map, you will find the location of the breakdowns that have plagued us over the past 2 years, and that seem to be attributable to human error, though we haven't once been able to tell to whom each might be attributed.
That's because everyone is busy protecting his back.
I'm afraid you're right. That's a characteristic of any bureaucracy, and Trentor's is the largest in history. But what do you think of the locations? The map had lit up with bright little red markings that looked like small pustules covering the land surface of Trantor.
Well, said Rach cautiously, they seem to be evenly spread.
Exactly, and that's what's interesting. One would expect that the older sections of Trantor, the longest domed sections, would have the most decayed infrastructure and would be more liable to events requiring quick human decision and laying the groundwork for possible human error. I'll superimpose the older sections of Trantor on the map in a bluish color, and you'll notice that the breakdowns don't seem to be taking place any oftener on the blue areas.
And
what I think it means, Rach, is that the breakdowns are not of natural origin, but are deliberately caused, and spread out in this fashion to affect as many people as possible, thus creating a dissatisfaction that is as widespread as possible.
It don't seem likely.
No? Then let's look at the breakdowns as spread through time rather than through space. The blue areas and the red spots disappeared, and for a time the map of Trantor was blank. And then the markings began to appear and disappear one at a time, here and there.
Notice, said Selden, that they don't appear in clumps in time either. One appears, then another, and so on, almost like the steady ticking of a metronome.
Do you think that's on purpose, too?
It must be. Whoever is bringing this about wants to cause as much disruption with as little effort as possible. So there's no use doing 2 at once, where one will partially cancel the other in the news and in the public consciousness. Each incident must stand out in full irritation.
The map went out and the lights went on. Selden returned the sphere, shrunken back to its original size, to his pocket.
Rach said, "Who would be doing all this?"
Selden said thoughtfully, "A few days ago, I received a report of a murder in Y Sector."
"That's not unusual," said Rach. "Even though Y isn't one of your really lawless sectors, there must be lots of murders there every day." Hundreds, said Selden, shaking his head. We've had bad days when the number of deaths by violence on Trantor as a whole approaches the million-a-day mark. Generally, there's not much chance of finding every culprit, every murderer. The dead just enter the books as statistics. This one, however, was unusual. The man had been knifed, but unskillfully. He was still alive when found, just barely. He had time to gasp out one word before he died, and that word was chief. That roused a certain curiosity, and he was actually identified. He works in Anamoria, and we don't know what he was doing and why. But some worthy officer managed to dig up the fact that he was an old Joranumite. His name was Kaspal Kaspalov, and he is well known to have been one of the intimates of Laskan Joranum. And now he's dead. Knifed. Rach frowned. Do you suspect another Joranumite conspiracy, Dad? There aren't any Joranumites around anymore. It wasn't long ago that your mother asked me if I thought that the Joranumites were still active, and I told her that any odd belief always retained a certain cadre, sometimes for centuries. They're usually not very important, just splinter groups that simply don't count. Still, what if the Joranumites have kept up an organization? What if they have retained a certain strength? What if they are capable of killing someone they consider a traitor in their ranks? And what if they are producing these breakdowns as a preliminary to seizing control? That's an awful lot of what-ifs, Dad. I know that, and I might be totally wrong. The murder happened in Y, and as it so happens, there have been no infrastructure breakdowns in Y. What does that prove? It might prove that the center of the conspiracy is in Y, and that the conspirators don't want to make themselves uncomfortable, only the rest of Trantor. It also might mean that it's not the Joranumites at all, but members of the old Wyan family, who still dream of ruling the Empire once again. Oh boy, Dad, you're building all this on very little. I know. Now, suppose it is another Joranumite conspiracy. Joranum had as his right-hand man Gambol Dean Namarti. We have no record of Namarti's death, no record of his having left Trantor, no record of his life over the last decade or so. That's not terribly surprising. After all, it's easy to lose one person among 40 billion. There was a time in my life when I tried to do just that. Of course, Namarti may be dead. That would be the easiest explanation. But he may not be. What do we do about it? Selden sighed. The logical thing would be to turn to the security establishment, but I can't. I don't have Demerzel's presence. He could cow people. I can't. He had a powerful personality. I'm just a mathematician. I shouldn't be First Minister at all. I'm not cut out for it. And I wouldn't be if the Emperor weren't fixated on psychohistory to a far greater extent than it deserves. You're kind of whipping yourself, ain't you, Dad? Yes, I suppose I am. But I have a picture of myself going to the security establishment, for instance, with what I have just shown you on the map. He pointed to the now empty tabletop. And arguing that we were in great danger of some conspiracy of unknown consequence and nature. They would listen solemnly, and after I had left, they would laugh among themselves about the crazy mathematician, and then do nothing. Then what do we do about it? Said Rach, returning to the point. It's what you will do about it, Rach. I need more evidence, and I want you to find it for me. I would send your mother, but she won't leave me under any circumstances. I myself can't leave the palace grounds at this time. Next to Doors and myself, I trust you. More than Doris and myself, in fact. You're still quite young. You're strong. You're a better Heliconian twister than I ever was. And you're smart. Mind you now, I don't want you to risk your life. No heroism, no daring do. I couldn't face your mother if anything happened to you. Just find out what you can. Perhaps you'll find that Namarti is alive and operating, or dead. Perhaps you'll find out that the Joranumites are an active group, or moribund. Perhaps you'll find out that the Wyan ruling family is active, or not. Any of that would be interesting, but not vital. What I want you to find out is whether the infrastructure breakdowns are of human manufacture, as I think they are. And far more important still, if they are deliberately caused, what else the conspirators plan to do. It seems to me they must have plans for some major coup, and if so, I must know what that will be. Rach said cautiously, Do you have some kind of plan to get me started? Yes, indeed, Rach. I want you to go down to the area of Y where Kaspalov was killed. Find out, if you can, if he was an active Joranumite, and see if you can't join a Joranumite cell yourself. Maybe that's possible. I can always pretend to be an old Joranumite. It's true that I was pretty young when Jojo was sounding off, but I was very impressed by his ideas. It's even sort of true. Well, yes, but there's one important catch. You might be recognized. After all, you're the son of the First Minister. You have appeared on Holovision now and then, and you have been interviewed concerning your views on sector equality. Sure, but... No buts, Rach. You'll wear elevated shoes to add 3 centimeters to your height. And we'll have someone show you how to change the shape of your eyebrows and make your face fuller and change the timbre of your voice. Rach shrugged. A lot of trouble for nothing. And, said Selden with a distinct quaver, you will shave off your mustache. Rach's eyes widened, and for a moment he sat there in appalled silence. Finally, he said in a hoarse whisper, Shave my mustache? Clean as a whistle. No one would recognize you without it. But it can't be done. Like cutting off your... Like castration. Selden shook his head. It's just a cultural curiosity. Hugo Emeril is as Dalite as you are, and he wears no mustache. Hugo is a nut. I don't think he's alive at all, except for his mathematics. He's a great mathematician, and the absence of a mustache does not alter that fact. Besides, it's not castration. Your mustache will grow back in 2 weeks. 2 weeks? It'll take 2 years to reach this... He put his hand up as though to cover and protect it. Selden said inexorably, Rach, you have to do it. It's a sacrifice you must make. If you act as my spy with your mustache, you may come to harm. I can't take that chance. I'd rather die, said Rach violently. Don't be melodramatic, said Selden severely. You would not rather die. And this is something you must do. However, and here he hesitated, don't say anything about it to your mother. I will take care of that. Rach stared at his father in frustration, and then said in a low and despairing tone, All right, Dad. Selden said, I will get someone to supervise your disguise, and then you will go to Y by airjet. Buck up, Rach. It's not the end of the world. Rach smiled wanly
and Selden watched him leave, a deeply troubled look on his face. A mustache could easily be regrown, but a son could not. Selden knew perfectly well that he was sending Rach into danger. Chapter 9. We all have our small illusions, and Cleon, Emperor of the Galaxy, King of Trantor, and a wide collection of other titles that on rare occasions could be called out in a long, sonorous roll, was convinced that he was a person of democratic spirit. It always angered him when he was warned off a course of action by Demerzel, or later by Selden, on the grounds that such action would be looked on as tyrannical or despotic. Cleon was not a tyrant or despot by disposition, he was certain. He only wanted to take firm and decisive action. He spoke many times with nostalgic approval of the days when emperors could mingle freely with their subjects. But now, of course, when the history of coups and assassinations, actual or attempted, had become a dreary fact of life, the emperor had, of necessity, been shut off from the world. It is doubtful that Cleon, who had never in his life met with people except under the most constricted of conditions, would really have felt at home in offhand encounters with strangers, but he always imagined he would enjoy it. He was excited, therefore, for the rare chance of talking to one of the underlings on the grounds, to smile and to doff the trappings of imperial rule for a few minutes. It made him feel democratic. There was this gardener whom Selden had spoken of, for instance. It would be fitting, even a pleasure, to reward him belatedly for his loyalty and bravery, and to do so himself, rather than leaving it to some functionary. He therefore arranged to meet the fellow in the spacious rose garden, which was in full bloom. That would be appropriate, Cleon thought, but of course they would have to bring the gardener there first. It was unthinkable for the emperor to be made to wait. It is one thing to be democratic, quite another to be inconvenienced. The gardener was waiting for him among the roses, his eyes wide, his lips trembling. It occurred to Cleon that it was possible that no one had told the man the exact reason for the meeting. Well, he would reassure him in kindly fashion. Except that, now he came to think of it, he could not remember the fellow's name. He turned to one of the officials at his side and said, "What is the gardener's name?" "Sire, it is Mandel Gruber. He has been a gardener here for 30 years. The emperor nodded and said, "Ah, Gruber, how glad I am to meet a worthy and hard-working gardener." "Sire," mumbled Gruber, his teeth chattering, "I am not a man of many talents, but it is always my best I try to do on behalf of your gracious self." Of course," said the emperor, wondering if the gardener suspected him of sarcasm. These men of the lower class lacked the finer feelings that came with refinement and manners, which always made any attempt at democratic display difficult. Cleon said, "I have heard from my first minister of the loyalty with which you once came to his aid, and of your skill in taking care of the grounds. The first minister tells me that he and you are quite friendly." "Sire, the first minister is most gracious to me, but I know my place. I never speak to him unless he speaks first." "Quite, Gruber. That shows good manners on your part. But the first minister, like myself, is a man of democratic impulses, and I trust his judgment of people." Gruber bowed low. The emperor said, "As you know, Gruber, Chief Gardener Malcomber is quite old and longs to retire,
The responsibilities are becoming greater than even he can bear.
Sire, the chief gardener is much respected by all the gardeners. May he be spared for many years, so that we can all come to him for the benefit of his wisdom and judgment.
Well said, Gruber, said the emperor carelessly. But you very well know that that is just mumbo-jumbo. He is not going to be spared, at least not with the strength and wit necessary for the position. He himself requests retirement within the year, and I have granted him that. It remains to find a replacement.
Oh, sire, there are 50 men and women in this grand place who could be chief gardener.
I dare say, said the emperor, but my choice has fallen upon you.
The emperor smiled graciously. This was the moment he had been waiting for. Gruber would now, he expected, fall to his knees in an ecstasy of gratitude. He did not, and the emperor frowned. Gruber said, Sire, it is an honor that is too great for me, entirely.
Nonsense, said Cleon, offended that his judgment should be called into question. It is about time that your virtues are recognized. You will no longer have to be exposed to weather of all kinds at all times of the year. You will have the chief gardener's office, a fine place, which I will have redecorated for you, and where you can bring your family. You do have a family, don't you, Gruber?
Yes, sire. A wife and two daughters, and a son-in-law.
Very good. You will be comfortable. And you will enjoy your new life, Gruber. You will be indoors, Gruber, and out of the weather, like a true Trantorian.
Sire, consider that I am an Anacreonian by upbringing.
I have considered, Gruber. All worlds are alike to the Emperor. It is done. The new job is what you deserved.
He nodded his head and stalked off. Cleon was satisfied with this latest show of his benevolence. Of course, he could have used a little more gratitude from the fellow, a little more appreciation. But at least the task was done. And it was much easier to have this done than to settle the matter of the failing infrastructure. Cleon had, in a moment of testiness, declared that whenever a breakdown could be attributed to human error, the human being in question should forthwith be executed.
Just a few executions, he said, and it will be remarkable how careful everyone will become.
I'm afraid, sire, Selden had said, that this type of despotic behavior would not accomplish what you wish. It would probably force the workers to go on strike. And if you try to force them back to work, there would then be an insurrection. And if you try to replace them with soldiers, you will find that they do not know how to control the machinery, so that breakdowns will begin to take place much more frequently. It was no wonder that Cleon turned to the matter of appointing a chief gardener with relief. As for Gruber, he gazed after the departing emperor with the chill of sheer horror. He was going to be taken from the freedom of the open air and condemned to the constriction of four walls. Yet, how could one refuse the emperor? Chapter 10 Rach looked in the mirror of his Y hotel room somberly. It was a pretty run-down hotel room, but Rach was not supposed to have too many credits. He did not like what he saw. His mustache was gone, his sideburns were shortened, his hair was clipped at the sides and back. He looked plucked. Worse than that, as a result of the change in his facial contours, he looked baby-faced. It was disgusting, nor was he making any headway. Selden had given him the security reports on Kaspar Kasparov's death, which he had studied. There wasn't much there. Just that Kasparov had been murdered, and that the local security officers had come up with nothing of importance in connection with that murder. It seemed quite clear that the security officers attached little or no importance to it anyway. That was not surprising. In the last century, the crime rate had risen markedly in most worlds, certainly in the grandly complex world of Trantor. And nowhere were the local security officers up to the job of doing anything useful about it. In fact, the security establishment had declined in numbers and efficiency everywhere, and, while this was hard to prove, had become more corrupt. It was inevitable this should be so, with pay refusing to keep pace with the cost of living. One must pay civil officials to keep them honest. Failing that, they would surely make up for their inadequate salaries in other ways. Selden had been preaching this doctrine for some years now, but it did no good. There was no way to increase wages without increasing taxes, and the populace would not sit still for increased taxes. It seemed they would rather lose 10 times the credits in graft. It was all part, Selden had said, of the general deterioration of imperial society over the previous 2 centuries. Well, what was Raich to do? He was here at the hotel where Kasparov had lived during the days immediately before his murder. Somewhere in the hotel, there might be someone who had something to do with that, or who knew someone who had. It seemed to Raich that he must make himself conspicuous. He must show an interest in Kasparov's death, and then someone would get interested in him and pick him up. It was dangerous, but if he could make himself sound harmless enough, they might not attack him immediately. Well, Raich looked at his time band. There would be people enjoying their pre-dinner aperitifs in the bar. He might as well join them and see what would happen, if anything. Chapter 11. In some respects, Y could be quite puritanical. This was true of all the sectors, though the rigidity of one sector might be completely different from the rigidity of another. Here, the drinks were not alcoholic, but were synthetically designed to stimulate in other ways. Raich did not like the taste, finding himself utterly unused to it. But it meant that he could sip his drink slowly and look around. He caught the eye of a young woman several tables away, and had difficulty in looking away. She was attractive, and it was clear that Y's ways were not puritanical in every fashion. After a few moments, the young woman smiled slightly and rose. She drifted toward Raich's table, while Raich watched her speculatively. He could scarcely, he thought with marked regret, afford a side adventure just now. She stopped for a moment when she reached Raich, and then let herself slide smoothly into an adjacent chair. "Hello," she said. "You don't look like a regular here." Raich smiled. "I'm not. Do you know all the regulars?" "Just about," she said, unembarrassed. "My name is Manella. What's yours?" Raich was more regretful than ever. She was quite tall, taller than he himself was without his heels, something he always found attractive. Had a milky complexion and long, softly wavy hair that had distinct glints of dark red in it. Her clothing was not too garish, and she might, if she had tried a little harder, have passed as a respectable woman of the not-too-hard-working class. Raich said, "My name doesn't matter. I don't have many credits."
"Oh, too bad."
Manella made a face.
Can't you get a few?
I'd like to. I need a job. Do you know of any?
What kind of job?
Rach shrugged.
I don't have any experience in anything fancy, but I ain't proud.
Manella looked at him thoughtfully.
I'll tell you what, Mr. Nameless. Sometimes it doesn't take any credits at all.
Rach froze at once. He had been successful enough with women, but with his mustache. His mustache. What could she see in his baby face? He said,
Tell you what, I had a friend living here a couple of weeks ago, and I can't find him. Since you know all the regulars, maybe you know him. His name is Kaspalov.
He raised his voice slightly.
Kaspal Kaspalov.
Manella stared at him blankly and shook her head.
I don't know anybody by that name.
Too bad. He was a Joranumite, and so am I. Again a blank look. Do you know what a Joranumite is? She shook her head.
No. I've heard the word, but I don't know what it means. Is it some kind of job?
Rach felt disappointed. He said,
It would take too long to explain.
It sounded like a dismissal, and after a moment of uncertainty, Manella rose and drifted away. She did not smile, and Rach was a little surprised that she had remained as long as she did. Well, Selden had always insisted that Rach had the capacity to inspire affection, but surely not in a businesswoman of this sort. For them, payment was the thing. His eyes followed Manella automatically as she stopped at another table where a man was seated by himself. He was of early middle age, with butter-yellow hair slicked back. He was very smooth-shaven, but it seemed to Rach that he could have used a beard, his chin being too prominent and a bit asymmetric. Apparently, Manella had no better luck with this beardless one,